This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 31st in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have with me here today, Matt Bishop. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Gary.
Matt Bishop is a professor of computer science at UC Davis. Matt holds a PhD in computer security from Purdue, an actual PhD in computer security. Matt is interested in secure design, vulnerability analysis, and other aspects of security, and is well published in the academic literature. But Matt has also made important inroads in the commercial side of security, lecturing for SANS and focusing much of his writing on security education. Matt is co-editor of the Education Department in IEEE S&P Magazine, our famous co-sponsors. And Matt's book, Computer Security, Art and Science, is an important textbook in the space. Matt lives in Davis with his wife, Holly, 4 kids, some cats, a rabbit, and some chickens. Is that right?
And a dog.
I forgot the dog. I'm sorry. We'll get back to that in a minute. So you've been one of the only professors of computer science with a PhD in security, actually in security. Was SPAF your advisor?
No, SPAF wasn't. I should say the degree is in computer science, but the area I studied was computer security.
Well, that's pretty impressive, though, because a lot of people that are computer security people didn't really study computer security, which is good and bad.
Dorothy Denning was my advisor. I left Purdue about 3 years before Gene Spafford came there.
Even showed up. So you know Dorothy was a previous victim of Silver Bullet.
Yes.
Yes, which was a lot of fun.
She's absolutely wonderful. She's brilliant. And was, well, as far as I can tell, the best advisor I'd have ever had.
That's very good. You're a lucky guy. So
yes.
What got you interested in computer security in the first place way back when?
I was studying applied mathematics at Berkeley, and I became very much interested in privacy and the law. I thought about going into law school for a little bit, but decided my talents weren't really in arguing cases or things like that. So I looked for an area where law and mathematics and privacy converged, and that led me to computer security.
Wow.
So I started, I wrote to several places to see if they had programs in it or if there were people who taught it, and wound up going to Purdue.
When was that?
I went to Purdue in 1979.
Wow. So, see, you anticipated this unbelievable tidal wave and the important intersection of privacy and computers and the law and all this stuff that everybody else is getting huffy-puffy about.
Well,
bajillion years ago.
Well, what to me was so interesting is most of the people I met who were in security were there to protect computer systems or for national security.
Mm-hmm.
Matters. And for a little bit of time, I felt that people weren't paying that much attention to privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Then I learned about cryptography, and people there were paying a lot of attention to privacy.
Yep.
And pretty soon people began looking at privacy from a non-cryptographic standpoint. Where databases were merging and so forth, and now I'm absolutely thrilled that it's probably, if not the dominant topic, one of the dominant topics of the field.
It absolutely is, and it's something that we still have a lot of work to do in,
yes,
unfortunately. So one area of study very important to you is the notion of security education and how to do it. Can you explain how you cover both black hat activities, breaking systems, and white hat activities, building systems properly to be secure in a solid program kind of together?
Well, two ways. The first way is to help people understand why you want to use the white hat measures, as you call them, to protect systems. They have to understand what nasty people can do.
Mm-hmm.
So you teach them what the black hats, as you call as they're called, can do to the systems, and then how to defend the systems. That basically gives them motivation to learn how to defend. Mm-hmm. But what I've also found is that if you simply teach people how to defend, they don't really understand how attackers work.
I think that's right.
So they often think of defense as sort of a cookbook. And as a result, an attacker who, a good attacker, will look at a system, see what the people who are protecting it expect, and then do something entirely unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
And this way, you can often get around the defenses of the system. So when you teach how to defend, you also have to teach how people attack in order for the defenders to be able to adapt very rapidly to the attacks and, in fact, in some cases, detect them. When I do this, I also provide a very healthy dose of ethics. For example, in my undergraduate classes, one of the projects I've run is attack a server, which is on an isolated network. So we protect the network, and the students have to log into the network before they can attack the system. And then in addition to that, we go through what are the ethical rules, what's good, what's bad, what is allowed, what is not allowed. And every day, every morning, I teach the class, I spend about the first 5 minutes working through a puzzle with the students, asking them, how does this apply to computer security? What should you do in this situation? That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And a good half of the puzzles I give tend to be on ethics.
Very nice. So I think there's another aspect of it, too, that I'm interested in your opinion about, which is it seems like breaking systems is somehow sexier and more appealing to base human nature than building things properly. Do you see that, too? So there's sort of sex appeal.
I'm not sure it's sexier, as you put it, than building something, right? But on the other hand, it is definitely a lot more fun to most people.
Right.
And I'm not quite sure why, but I think it's, well, an appeal to the base instincts is certainly one of them. If you do this in a controlled way, it's a nice way to be a crook without being a crook, so to speak.
I call it the NASCAR effect, too, you know, which I think it's related to for obvious reasons.
Right, I'll go along with that. The other thing I think, too, is it's rather like a puzzle. It's trying to figure out what the other person is thinking and how to get around them. And people who like games, chess games, board games, things like that, often really enjoy the challenge of trying to figure out where the problems are.
Right, right.
And this is a good way to do that.
So you've also been very active in software security since approximately forever. So tell us a bit about this new scheme you're helping to spearhead to work security analysis and secure coding into the wider computer science curriculum for students.
This grew out of something which I was working on a couple of years ago. One of the problems we have in the field, as you know, is that code isn't really being written well. And by well, I mean the programs are typically non-robust and there are often security problems with them. So the one approach is to inject security into every single class. Problem is, number one, the classes are already overloaded in terms of curriculum. And number two, that would require all faculty members to learn about security. And for many people, security simply is not interesting. It's not what they do well. It's not where their talents lie. And so personally, I would consider that quite unreasonable.
Mm-hmm.
The other approach is to require an extra class in software security that everyone must take.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the curriculum is already so loaded in the computer science community that it's not clear that's going to work.
Right.
So my parents are both literary people. My mom's a literary agent. My dad was a writer. And so I looked over to the literary community because we all express ourselves using English, at least in the United States. And one of the things colleges put a lot of emphasis on is writing well. But if you look at the English curriculum, there's very little on actual writing. There's a lot of practice, but there's very little on how you actually do it.
Mm-hmm.
Same if you go to law school. There's a lot of writing, but there may be one short class in legal writing, and that's it. Well, the way they imbue people with writing well is they have clinics where you can take your essay or your brief or whatever, and run it by the clinicians. And they won't judge the content. But what they will do is look and see whether or not it's structured well, whether or not you make your points. They'll point out grammatical errors. They'll help you figure out how to construct a much stronger argument, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We don't have anything like that in programming, in computer science curriculums. Mm-hmm. Now, when we write a when we learn to program, we learn all of the we learn the basic rules of robustness, do error checking, check your array bounds, stuff like that.
Do we really? Wow.
Well, at least in the introductory class.
We're supposed to.
We're supposed to. But when you go beyond that, the emphasis is on getting the algorithm right, getting the program right, getting the results right, and not so much in did you construct this well. Mm-hmm. So one of my grad students was the TA for my operating system class. And in that class, we had students modify a small kernel, the Minix kernel. And what he did, we did interactive grading. So as he graded the first assignment, he went through it, and actually for all the groups, he said, you know, this code works. It's horribly written. It's not well done. If I see this again, I'm going to take 20 points off out of 100.
Right.
So the students came and complained to me.
Right. And then you set up a solution for that.
Well, what I said was absolutely right. I agree the TA should not have said 20 points, but I would have said 40, but we'll go with the 20. The next assignment, the quality improved dramatically, and he didn't have to take anything off. So this led me to thinking that if we combine that approach with the idea of a programming clinic, where people could come and have someone look through their programs and not look at whether or not it produced the right results for the assignment, but instead, is there a way I can easily crash this program? Is there a way I can breach security if security is involved and so forth? Mm-hmm. And give the students feedback that might improve the situation. So a couple of years ago, we're a center of excellence, so we applied for a capacity building grant from the NSA to run this. And we ran it, and we had very small funding, but we were able to run it for two classes. Mm-hmm. And in one class, the quality of the assignments moved markedly. And in the other class, which was an introductory class, the same thing happened. Mm-hmm. So it seemed to be a reasonable approach, and it's worth trying. We need more metrics to determine how effective this is and under what conditions this will work. So there's a lot of research that has to be done. But on the other hand, when we've tried it, it's worked spectacularly, I would say.
You know, there are other disciplines that do that sort of thing, too. And sometimes, like I'm thinking of architecture, for example, and juries and the way that you learn how to design buildings.
I didn't know that. That's neat.
Yep. And I guess if you think about it, pair programming and some of the agile methods and maybe even Fagan reviews have some amount of that in there, too. So
right.
It seems like a very natural idea. It's cool that you tried it out.
Well, also, it's natural for companies that want to get involved with universities but don't have a lot of money to, you know, instead of paying for things. What they might be able to do is if they have people who are good at this sort of thing within the company, have them come over and work at the clinic for like an hour or a week or something like that.
It's a good recruiting maneuver.
Extremely good recruiting maneuver, and also would impress upon the students, look, this stuff isn't just academic that you can forget when you leave the ivory tower. It's stuff you'll actually be expected to apply in the real world at a real job. And that has an amazing effect on students, I've found.
That's very nice. So let's get back in the ivory tower a little bit.
Okay.
As a scientist, you know the importance of literature and knowing all about previous work. So you put together a very cool collection of seminal papers. I guess you did that maybe a decade ago for computer security?
Just about, yeah.
Yeah, which was extremely cool. In your view, what are the top two forgotten papers, assuming we all remember Salzer and Schroeder?
Okay. That would have been number one.
I know.
The first one is the Ware Report, which basically set the field in motion.
Right.
Because it very clearly, even though it's the technology it talks about and such is dated now, it very clearly lays out the problems in a way that's quite easy to understand. Mm-hmm. The second one quite frankly, is the Bell-LaPadula paper. Mm-hmm. Because pretty much everyone learns the lattice version of the model, which is much simpler then, which is a very nice exposition of it. But the original paper has a lot of very neat insights into it. And the methodology they used to build the model is quite fascinating.
Very good. Well, I hope everybody who's listening goes and gets those things. We'll put links on the website to the two papers that you mentioned.
Great.
So together with Mike Dilger, remember Mike?
Oh, yes,
you did
very
some
well.
Very important work on talk to, time of check to time of use, even building a tool to scan for talk to problems. I think if you want a primer for that, you can see Chapter 9 of Building Secure Software. So time and state issues seem to be more and more important as time goes by in computer security, especially when trust boundaries are crossed. So what can we do to make progress against these sorts of very complex time-related, trust boundary-related issues, especially given our head-first dive into Web 2.0 and AJAX and all these things?
Oh, boy, you like the easy questions, don't you? To be honest, at this point, I'm not sure. The problem is that we have to come up with ways to understand the temporal ordering of things before we can start analyzing, mm-hmm. before we can start correcting problems. And we have to understand how the order can be perturbed. Where with time of check to time of use, it's very easy because there are really only two things involved.
Yeah, you have your critical section is clear.
Exactly. But the problem with doing this sort of work over the web is while there is a critical section, adopt one point of view, in other words, either the service point of view or the client's point of view or something like that, and study it from that point of view. And occasionally, it may be that you think you've corrected it at one end and you haven't corrected it at the other. Basically, it's a distributed programming problem, and calling those hairy is putting it mildly, particularly from the security point of view.
Yeah, and for me, that is a class, a category of problems that's just going to take on more importance as these massively distributed systems come into play. You can already see this in the online game stuff that I've been screwing around with lately. But, you know, I just think it's getting more important for people to focus some attention on that, kind of get past the usual bug parade and focus some attention on time and state.
Well, one thing we need to do is go back to focusing on the deep underlying problems. Mm-hmm. A lot of the work that I'm seeing is absolutely brilliant, without question, but it tends to bubble up and look at the problems that we know about. What I'm beginning to see more of, and what I really hope we continue to push on very, very hard, is that those problems are symptoms of much deeper problems. And we seem not to be paying as much attention to the deeper problems of, as you pointed out, time and so forth, mm-hmm. and instead going for their manifestations, like time of check to time of use, race conditions, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And on individual systems, that's, you know, the distinction is probably not that severe. On distributed systems or network-based systems, it's critical. And we have to understand more of that underlying, of those underpinnings before we can really start solving the problems that are higher up. Mm-hmm. Currently, we're doing Band-Aids, but what we need is major surgery.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. So as you know from our work together on the Fortify tab, I'm pretty optimistic about the progress that we appear to be making in software security. Do you feel the same way? You think we're making progress?
I think we're definitely making progress. I think there's a long way to go, but when I look at the world as it is now compared to 10 years ago or even, you know, 8 years ago, my hope is beginning to be restored. Let's put it that way.
That's good. So what role should training play in a large-scale software security initiative?
Training is a strange beast because typically you train for a particular system or in a particular environment or in a particular language. Mm-hmm. And it's critical that people who are working there understand the threats, understand the limitations of their tools and of what they do. And so I would call training extremely important. equally important is education, where you focus on what underlies the training, where you focus on the principles and the concepts and so forth. And then once you've got that, then you train for individual systems. Mm-hmm. What you'll find when you do that is the education will take longer than the training, but the training will be fairly quick. And when you move to a new environment or to a new system, the retraining will be much, much quicker, because you'll be able to relate what you're seeing to the underlying concepts.
Boy, that is super good, Matt. I'm glad you put it that way. You sort of anticipated a question I was going to ask next about this notion of certifying developers for software security, you know, whether or not they're any good at software security versus a CS degree. And I think you just said the answer.
Yeah, both of them have their place.
Yeah.
You simply don't want to confuse the two. They're very different.
Well, that's another matter.
Yeah.
So current security hotshots like Jeremiah Grossman at White Hat and RSnake, Robert Hansen, bemoan the idea of trying to secure the web browser as something that's pretty much impossible. They say, it's so screwed up, we're never going to be able to fix it. And, you know, some of us have been moaning about this since, oh, say, 1995, like, say, you and me. But what can we do to address the browser as a security disaster problem? Anything?
Well, for current browsers, we can keep putting Band-Aids on them.
Uh-huh.
Beyond that, my suspicion is the browsers will need a fundamental rewrite, mm-hmm. because we need to build assurance into these things. And the browsers were typically not designed with much security in mind. They were designed, some of them were designed with sandboxes for Java and so forth, mm-hmm. but the security threats are very different now.
Mm-hmm.
I think, unfortunately, the only way to improve browsers drastically is to build new ones.
Yeah, and so
build
a total reset.
Do a reset and build them using, I'm not sure I'd call them high assurance techniques, but maybe medium assurance techniques.
Right. So the question is whether that be a Control-Alt-Delete approach or an L1AB approach. What do you think?
I just call it a, okay, we built one, we built the prototypes, we've learned from them, now let's go do it right approach.
So the last question, how many feet do you have in your menagerie, not including the children? So you got to count up the feet of all of your beasts. Just so you know, in my menagerie, there are 72 feet.
Okay, not counting the children, myself or my wife, there are, let's see, 26.
26 feet. Oh, I got you beat.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That's a lot of feet, though. That's more than most people have.
And bear in mind, some of them only have two. Oh, no, actually, oops, I take it back. I'm sorry, 32 feet.
Oh, you didn't count the chickens?
Well, no, I thought all the chickens had one leg. I counted the number of chickens instead of the feet.
And there you have it, another fascinating episode of Silver Bullet. This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The September-October 2008 issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue devoted to virtualization. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.